Kia ora and welcome to The Week in Review. I'm Paul Brennan with a selection of stories and interviews in RNZ News this week. Coming up in this podcast, with the stroke of a pen, the Defence Minister overrules the Environment Court on engine noise at Whenuapai Air Base. MediaWorks cuts shows on TV3, and young New Zealanders are flocking to support their favourite bird of the year.
They're just absolutely gorgeous. They're floofy, but they're also incredibly endangered. So they have got the same endangered species ranking as the takahe, as two species of kiwi, and as the field.
Coming up in the Week in Review. But first, two polls, 2 days running, have National running ahead of Labour and the popularity of the Prime Minister falling. Monday night's One News Colmar Brunton poll put National well clear on 47% to Labour's 40% and in a position to form a government with ACT. Sunday night's News Hub Reed Research poll put National 2 points ahead on 44%, not quite enough to beat a Labour-Greens coalition. Both polls showed Jacinda Ardern's popularity as preferred Prime Minister falling, though she remains well clear of opposition leader Simon Bridges, who's up but still in single digits. Joining Susie Ferguson on Tuesday's Morning Report was RNZ political editor Jane Patterson.
The lowest for Labour since the election of Simon Bridges as leader here.
That's right. So just taking Simon Bridges' election back in February 2018 and looking at how the polls have tracked for both parties in both the One News, Colmar Brunton and the News Hub poll as well. And both of these results are the lowest for Labour in either of those polls. So that's going to be a concern because it is showing that downwards trend. Now, Colmar Brunton, the One News, polls much more regularly than News Hub, but we are seeing that downwards momentum for them. And in terms of the preferred Prime Minister stakes, as you mentioned in your intro, still well ahead of Simon Bridges, but also that slight downwards trend apart from a post-bump after the March 15th attacks and the budget for Ms Ardern, and including in this Colmar Brunton poll.
I guess the movement is interesting as well. There's not that much difference in the numbers, but it does translate to very different outcomes should that be the result on election night.
That's right. So a 7-point gap in the One News poll between National and Labour and about 2.5 in the News Hub poll. But interesting that the votes are trading between National and Labour. In the past, we have seen with Labour in particular, when it went down, the Greens went up, you saw a bit more of movement on either side of the spectrum. But really, this is a head-to-head battle between National and Labour. And I think it also shows that the party that has dropped in this poll in particular, Labour, it's not necessarily about the coalition, it's specifically about that party, because New Zealand First and the Greens have actually bumped up a little bit. So we look at the handling of the sexual assault scandal, we look at specific Labour policies like KiwiBuild, they are directed at that party.
So how worried will Labour be about this?
Well, I think apart from the party vote and the reflection, of course, on the leadership, which is key for any party, is another interesting part of this poll, economic outlook. Now, for the first time, there's a question about whether you think the economy will be better or worse. It took a plunge after the election in 2017. Now, apart from a spike in October last year when more people thought the economy would be worse, this is the second time only that has happened again in this poll, and now more people at 41% think it will be worse. Now that is going to be a concern because you have to be seen as a good economic manager, and that is going to be a direct line of attack for National.
That's our political editor Jane Patterson on Morning Report. Then Giles Beckford was joined by the Prime Minister, Jacinda Ardern.
What's gone wrong? Why are you... Well, the trend is not...
I have a right of reply.
The trend is not your friend in this case, is it? It's all downhill.
No, I certainly wouldn't interpret that way at all. In fact, we are doing better than the numbers that we were elected on, and we were able to form a government based on that. And so to actually have your support lift since election, I take heart in that. Equally on the issue of the economy, actually, if you ask a member of the public whether or not you think that there's clouds on the horizon, then clearly there are. New Zealand is faring well, though. 3.9% unemployment, some of the lowest we've seen. Wages, we've seen good growth relative to the last decade. We're running a surplus, we've got the books in good shape. That gives us choices going forward, particularly as we see on the horizon other economies not faring nearly as well.
What are those choices? Because quite clearly this is supposed to be the year of delivery, the year of transformation, and really it's more of the same. Looking at that economic outlook measure there in that poll, people clearly don't think that the times are going to get better.
No, and I don't actually agree with that sentiment either. Of course, relative to other countries, we are actually faring well. We're in good shape and there's a lot to be positive about. And I do think we need to be careful not to talk ourselves into a funk. But domestically, there are things that also we can do to buffer ourselves. And over the last 2 years, we've been doing that. We've been investing in infrastructure, things like rebuilding Middlemore and Dunedin hospitals. We've been building new schools and classrooms for 100,000 students. We've been helping boost business productivity with things like bringing back the R&D tax credit. We've focused on regional economies, so trying to transition the Taranaki economy, for instance.
So why is sentiment through the floor?
Fossil fuels. And all of this, I think people do understand, takes time. We had 9 years of a real underinvestment. In 2 years, we've made good progress, but there is more to do.
So why is sentiment through the floor? And really, don't you have to accept that you don't have time? You've got a year left to the next election at best. And on these numbers, you might struggle to get back in.
No, I dispute that. Of course, you're reflecting on perhaps in this poll, actually, it does matter whether or not you're able to form a coalition, and we've proven that we are able to do that. And in fact, one of the things that I've based my measure of success on in this coalition is the ability of our small party, the smaller parties in coalition with us, to maintain their strength. Now, you'll recall polls generally in between election cycles often have the smaller parties dip back. They haven't done that.
Are they wagging the tail?
No, not at all. In fact, you'll see, of course, that there are very specific policies for each of the parties we've formed government with, and I think that's demonstrated the strength of the coalition, that they've been able to have voice within our government and maintain their own identities, and that they've held up in the polls.
It can't be good that Winston Peters can stand up and grandstand on the immigration issue, for instance, saying how we stop them, how we change the policy, or that the Greens could actually sort of start to have an influence, which is really scaring the whole rural community.
In all of these policies, ultimately, we are a government that can only make changes through consensus. And in that consensus building, what we ultimately find is balance. Immigration, we're a government that's doubled our refugee quota. At the same time, we've tried to stop exploitation and make sure businesses can get the migrant labour and workforce they need. On climate change, we're making more progress than any government has ever made in that area, including things like the Zero Carbon Act, but at the same time, making sure that we bring our rural communities with us. And we've put a lot of effort into that because we know it's a big transition. Actually, consensus building, I think, does bring balance into the policy decisions that are being made.
Well, the look is that you're doing a lot of talk but very little walk. Are you worried by the appearance of Christopher Luxon on the...
A statement, but give me an example, because on anything, you know, if you choose any area of government, particularly an issue like, and I will front foot this, housing, we're building more housing than any government since the 1970s. Yes, we inherited a crisis. It is taking some time, longer than I would like, but we are making a difference. And I know that because I see the thousands of people who are either accessing transitional housing or getting into state housing because of the difference that we're making.
Are you worried about the appearance of Christopher Luxon and the prospect that he could, in time, perhaps have that attraction for people to join National, to go with National in the way that John Key did?
No. Ultimately, you'll know from my approach to politics. I really focus on others' political parties. My job is to make sure that we as a government are performing, and that's my focus.
The Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern speaking on Tuesday's Morning Report. With a stroke of a pen, Defence Minister Ron Mark has overruled an Environment Court decision on noise restrictions for plane engine testing at Auckland's Whenuapai Air Base. The developer, Neil Group, won a noise complaint case against the base in the Environment Court last month. But Ron Mark has now stepped in and used his special powers to exempt the airbase from the Resource Management Act on the grounds of national security. He told Lisa Owen on Checkpoint the court judgment is now meaningless and it's business as usual at Whenuapai.
People knew when they bought and moved into that area that there'd been an Air Force base there since the Second World War. People know that those aircraft are required to deploy at any time of the day or night. Very often, going out to search for people in peril on the sea, yachties, fishermen, they deploy to HADAR operations. Prior to deployment, they are required, which is standard aviation practice, to run their engines up and test them. That's quite aside from the testing that we might have to do after we've completed a maintenance schedule. And it's just unsafe to fly an aircraft without testing the engines before one even attempts to take off. So we have to do these things. It's part of the, you know, it's what we do. And it's just absolutely unacceptable to think that we would have an Environment Court ruling on the back of a property developer shutting down and not being able to operate after office hours when we're required to go out and search for someone who's in trouble.
So this exemption that you're able to sign off on, it's for the purposes of national security. Well, did this warrant such a sort of high-powered exemption? Because national security, do we meet that bar for that? Because what, the Prime Minister gets flown out of Whenuapai sometimes when she's going into to the Pacific nations and you have search and rescues coming from that base. Is this really an issue of national security?
I think there's a bigger question that still worries me, Lisa, and that is the whole question around encroachment and the ongoing challenges to military bases that were once set up in isolated locations, free from any sort of interference on their operations. I mean, you go back to Wigram, it was way out in the country outside of Christchurch. It eventually got built around and then shut down. A lot of it from complaints about the noise from the Harvards flying, and they were training officers, pilot officers to fly. Look at what we're facing now down in West Melton, where we have objections to people who've moved into the area on lifestyle blocks because of the noise from the rifle. That rifle range has been there 100 years. We've got similar challenges around, potentially around Linton and around Burnham. If you look at the amount of growth in the Rolleston area, and I've had numerous property developers make clear that they would like to actually to put more property development out in, on the fringes of Burnham, all of that eventually leads to impeding the ability of our Defence Force personnel.
So this was
to
about
train.
Stopping a precedent, was it, Minister? This was about getting in early and setting some ground rules as you see it.
I have to draw a line in the sand on this one. As far as I'm concerned, I cannot have impediments to the Air Force's operations out of Whenuapai full stop. The Air Force base was there a long time ago. People have moved. And here's the funny thing, Lisa. It's interesting. I look at the online petition raised by the residents of Helensville and particularly those around Whenuapai. It would appear that 17,000 people agree with me. They don't want the Air Force base removed or shut down. They're proud of the fact that our airwomen and our airmen deploy out of there. They're proud of the work they do. They understand the importance and significance of Whenuapai to the national security and to the Defence Force. So if 17,000 people who are resident in that area support the air base as continuing in the way it always has, what's the big deal? Oh, I guess the big deal is we've got a property developer who wants to make a stack of money based on an investment in land. We've got Auckland Council who redesignated the area despite objections, and now we're in the position we're in. I'm over it.
Before you go, Minister, I'm really curious. Did Air New Zealand ever make any submissions to you on the future of that particular site?
Nothing to me at all, Lisa. I was blindsided and gobsmacked. Look, can I say that since the departure of a certain person from the employment of Air New Zealand, I've had discussions with Air New Zealand. That conversation's off the table.
It's over then. Air New Zealand's bid for an airport, second airport there.
I think Air New Zealand now are fully aware of the strength of feeling of the local community around Whenuapai as well. The reaction from local residents was immediate and furious. And I think if they were to, you know, I mean, one, I just don't physically see how we could accommodate the car parking or the for the taxi stands, the bus stands, let alone the security provisions needed for flying out of there, let alone a passenger terminal, let alone all of those separate facilities that one, I just don't see how that would fit. But on top of that,
so to be still clear, has Minister, to get... Sorry to interrupt you, but I just want to be absolutely clear on this. You never received any kind of written submission or plan, suggestions or otherwise from Air New Zealand, formally from them, about this idea that Whenuapai could be used as a second domestic airport in New Zealand?
Not even a post-it, no.
Were they ever serious about it then?
Well, someone clearly was, because he made a big deal of it in the media and he had a hell of a lot to say. And it seemed to me that, you know, oh, to take the gentleman at his word, that they have done a lot of work. And I was just gobsmacked that, as I said to Air New Zealand in a private conversation, look, what you did is tantamount to someone coming up my drive and doing an assessment on what they would do with my home and my little lifestyle block. Should they decide to buy it? Should I be willing to sell it? Should they decide to have a conversation with me? I just found it all quite bizarre, quite frankly.
Defence Minister Ron Mark on Tuesday's Checkpoint programme. The results of the country's local body elections have seen a surge in younger people winning seats. Five mayors under 40 have been elected, and now a quarter of mayors are women, up from 19%. Joining Giles Beckford on Monday's Morning Report was Lower Hutt Mayor Campbell Barry. He's the country's youngest mayor at 28. Aaron Hawkins, who at 35 is Dunedin's first Green mayor. And new Opotiki Mayor Lynn Riestra, who is from the East Coast, which saw an upswing in female mayors.
Good morning to you all and congratulations. Let me start with you, Lynn Riestra. Are you part of the new surge, part of the new generation of people in local body government?
Well, I certainly don't fit into the category of being under 40. So I might be one of the oldest new mayors to be voted in. I'm not sure on that one. But I have been on council now for 6 years. And coming from a district that is majority Māori, I'm actually really excited to see that in those last 6 years, our council has been quite even, both about 50-50 Māori Pākehā and 50-50 male-female. So we're actually following a trend, but we do have a couple of younger men who have gotten in on our council seats. So I'm actually really excited about this new council moving into the new triennium.
Campbell Barry, you pulled off one of the bigger upsets by defeating the sitting mayor. Why do you think that was?
Well, I think it was a campaign focused on the issues here in the Hutt. So obviously a lot of people have been asking or talking about my age. But I've also been a councillor for the past 6 years, and I think we were talking around issues of our environment, transportation, particularly our Nine Eye Pool, which has been closed as well. Those issues resonated with voters, and I think they voted for a change in approach. We've also had a bit of a refresh in our council with six new councillors being elected as well, so I'm really looking forward to leading a refreshed team.
Aaron Hawkins, you've been on the council, but you replaced Dave Coulter. How much easier was it for you to perhaps, having rather than fighting an incumbent, being sort of, you know, a fresh face for amongst a larger pack?
I certainly think that in a campaign where you don't have an incumbent, you end up with a more positive campaign in general, because nobody has to prove that your current mayor is rubbish and that they would be the ideal replacement. You know, we took a positive message to our community, focused on the biggest issues that we have around transport, around housing, affordable housing, and our changing climate, and not just the mayoral election, but also the results in the council election show that our community is broadly supportive of the positive direction both the city and the council is heading in, and have given us a mandate to build on the work that we've done over the past two terms, and I think that's really exciting.
Just specific to you, you don't drive, do you?
No, which people find incomprehensible.
Not necessarily so. How are you going to get to council meetings? You're not going to take the council limo, are you? Or are you going to bike everywhere?
No staff, no. I usually get around by hitching to work and travelling by bus. I do have a learner's license, but I haven't ever learned how to drive. And ideally, I think we need to live in a society where people don't have to rely on driving themselves places, and we've got a long way to go before we achieve that, in Dunedin in particular.
Lynn Restra, three women have been elected to council, become mayors in the East Coast region. Why do you think that is, and what are the key issues do you think that you might have in common that you might even cooperate on?
Ah, gosh, that's a tough question so early on a Monday morning. So in the three areas, the long-standing mayors retired or stepped down. So that, again, as Andrew was saying, it gave a fresh slate for lots of people to stand up and consider themselves for the mayor. The fact that Gisborne or Portiki and Whakatane have all ended up with women mayor, I guess the people have said, right, let's give the women a chance to get in there and do a good job. I really don't know. A lot of the issues that we all face being in the East Coast area are quite similar. So I'm sure there will be quite a lot of cooperation and talk amongst us, as there already is.
Campbell Barry, how much do you think you'll need to cooperate, work with a new mayor in Wellington, Andy Foster?
Yeah, I think it's going to be an incredibly important relationship. I spoke with Andy yesterday. We were able to catch up briefly, and we've already arranged a time to go over some of the issues which we face as a region. And I'm looking forward to working with him and the entirety of the Wellington City Council. I think now it's just an opportunity to talk to my colleagues and work out a plan moving forward on some of those regional issues.
You're going to have to sit in the mayor's seat for the first time. Is that going to make you... feel good? Is it going to give you some sort of invigoration?
Yeah, it's exciting. It's certainly daunting as well. I think on Saturday when I got the news, there was obviously a level of excitement, but also knowing that now that there is an incredible amount of responsibility and I need to be working incredibly hard for my city, and that's what I'm going to do. But I just want to get cracking into it because there's so much for us to tackle.
Very quickly to each of you, the same question, which is climate change has been one of the issues to the fore, mentioned by lots of young people, big marches as we saw here in Wellington and around the country. To what extent is it going to be a key issue for your three-year term? Starting with you, Campbell Barry.
Yeah, this is going to be top of the agenda. There's no question that if we're not looking out for our environment and the changes that we're going to be facing and helping tackle that, then we won't have a city at all. So that's going to be near the top, and I've got some policies which I've already been campaigning on in this particular area, and I'm looking forward to working with the council to make sure that we do make it top of the agenda.
Lynn Restra.
Yes, well, a lot of work around climate change is already embedded into our long-term plan, and I think that every decision that we make in council has to reflect what's going to be happening over the next 50 to 100 years, remembering that part of what our work is actually planning for the future, not just 10 years, but well in advance. I certainly think that the next 3 years are really important from central government to make sure that they are leading the way in how this is going to be dealt with around our entire areas. But we've got a lot to be getting on with. We've got a lot of smaller settlements that are very close to the sea, and we're going to be needing to be having some really good, constructive, positive conversations with our communities moving forward.
And finally, you, Aaron Hawkins.
Yeah, it's definitely the single biggest issue that we face, and I'm proud of the work that Council has done over the past two terms and the decisions that we've made around climate action. I certainly think that that has been made possible by the fact that we have thousands of young people marching in the streets outside our office demanding that we do better. And that is what's driven the shift in both the political environment and the community feeling towards more urgent action, because
you know, if we don't transition to a zero carbon economy, then our long-term future in a more volatile climate looks pretty bleak. So, yeah, everything that we do from here on in needs to be filtered through that.
Dunedin's first Green Mayor, 35-year-old Aaron Hawkins, before him the new Opotiki Mayor, Lynn Riestra, and before her, Lower Hutt's new Mayor, Campbell Barry, the country's youngest at 28 years of age, speaking on Morning Report. MediaWorks has cut two popular comedy shows from TV3 in a further sign of the company's deepening economic problems. Long-running comedy panel show 7 Days has been reduced to just 12 episodes a year, and new comedy series New Zealand Today has been axed. Media Watch's Colin Peacock was in the Wellington Morning Report studio. He joined Susie Ferguson.
Why these shows?
Well, it's an interesting one. I mean, TV3 has, or 3 as it's now known, has marketed itself as the home of local comedy. It's been a real point of difference for the channel. But the statement that the company made yesterday said this: unfortunately, like all free-to-air content, it is not immune to the pressure we face as an industry in protecting and enhancing New Zealand and New Zealand stories on screen. So if you translate that out of the communication speak, they seem to be saying we need to turn a buck, we're in tight times, and this locally made comedy, it's popular, but doesn't pull enough of an audience from us. But, you know, programs come and go, even long-running ones. I had Jono and Ben on for years, for example. It's not the first time a show like the Guy Williams one, out for a season, not to return, doesn't come back. So partly I think this is being used as a kind of a lobbying tool to exaggerate MediaWorks' problems, because last night on TV3's show The Project, the host Jesse Mulligan went into an on-air editorial blaming the government for this, saying they've allowed TVNZ to operate as a non-profit, not making a dividend, and that this was unfair and had made it difficult for MediaWorks to operate. He made no mention there of the fact that the 7 Days show has had years of taxpayer support running into millions of dollars.
Well, so this is what I was going to say.
It's complicated.
Both of these shows are essentially, or in large part, publicly funded through New Zealand On Air. So if they're being cut, what does that say about TV3's finances?
Exactly. If they're saying even with this helping hand from the public, they don't want to put these programs on and it's not worth their while. I mean, this is the real point here, because our television system kind of depends upon this. I mean, other countries, they have public broadcasters like the ABC in the UK or the BBC, where taxes go direct to those, or the public pays a licence fee. They're accountable for how they spend it. Here in New Zealand, it depends upon producers pitching shows to these commercial television companies, and they then put them on, and the producers get paid from the public purse. So if this is not to be all one broadcaster, TVNZ, if MediaWorks are saying, well, it's not worth our while on 3 to do this with local productions, well, then that system starts to break down a bit. So all this needs a rethink. The government is rethinking it, and this is all in the background, and this is why not only MediaWorks but other pundits are making a big deal of what is at the moment just a kind of simple programming decision.
Yeah, because this is not coming sort of out of nowhere, essentially. You're right, there's Chris Farfoy, the minister, is due to come out fairly soon with essentially what could be quite a significant overhaul of media policy. Is this essentially a lobbying tool?
Yeah, I think it is. I think it really is. I mean, we've seen it, the company's chief executives at MediaWorks talking down the prospects of their company openly, from the chief executive down, talking about having to switch off TV channels. Now, I mean, as we were saying before, nowhere in the world would you find the public purse supporting a simple TV panel show news quiz for years and years and years on in prime time that's pulling an audience. So what the issue here is not TV3's Friday night comedy local lineup. The issue is how we spend near on $250 million a year on broadcasting and public media and get relatively little public service broadcasting for it. We're subsidising commercial television industry and television production, which is fine if that's to be the goal of the policy. But I think all of this needs a rethink. All of that's in the background. And this is why I think what is, as I said before, programs come, programs go, even if they're long-running ones, that's the real issue in the background.
And so I guess one of the other aspects of this is that these are, especially in the case of 7 Days, a real showcase for New Zealand comedy, for New Zealand comedians. what's going to happen to the talent pool?
Exactly. Well, I asked this question of Jane Wrightson, who's the chief executive of New Zealand On Air, saying, well, look, if for years TVNZ hasn't really been committed to screening local comedy, they just started the second series of Wellington Paranormal yesterday, so possibly a bad time to make that argument. But it is Three that has, over the years, committed to this. It's seeded talent. We've seen stars come out, like Guy Williams, for example, who emerged from that Jono and Ben show on television. Also, you know, the stand-up comedy scene. Some of these people have built their livelihoods around being able to get television money. So it is a big deal. So if Three is retreating from this because of their economic problems, it is an issue. Jane Wrightson said, well, look, the ideas, the scripts, there's no shortage of those. We get those. We still get those pitches. The problem we have is not enough money to spend on all the kinds of content we would like to see on New Zealand television and other media. They do fund comedy on the web and so on on-demand platforms for our broadcasters. Maybe we'll see some of that. But it remains to be seen whether TV3 is kind of bluffing and they replace their local comedy with something else and keep nurturing that in-house talent, or whether they do just bung on CSI or some overseas drama they think will make them a bigger margin, and it really does mean a shrinkage of local comedy on screen.
Because what does this mean to the free-to-air TV channels? Is this saying, you know, as we've been saying for some time, the future of broadcasting is not free-to-air, it is streaming, it's on the internet, there's a whole bunch of other ways to watch TV or to consume content now. Are TV channels becoming obsolete?
Possibly. In fact, New Zealand On Air say, because they're marking 30 years of existence this year, next month they've got some research out showing how people's habits have changed over those 30 years. It'll be fascinating to see how much they have and indeed haven't changed, and how the TV channels can adapt. But yeah, that's the sign here, I guess, is that even with this huge level of support, hundreds of thousands and millions of dollars in the case of 7 Days, if that's not enough to persuade a second channel in the market that is substantial that it's worth running these shows, then that system does start to break down. But all this really needs to be considered fully, because the system we have was devised 30 years ago, and it remains to be seen if the government is really going to tackle it in this review that's due to be signalled at the very least by the end of the year.
That's RNZ Media Watch's Colin Peacock on Thursday's Morning Report. New Zealand First starts its unofficial election campaign in Christchurch this weekend at its annual party conference. Two recent polls both had the party below the threshold at 4% support, and it comes after recent leaks of sensitive party documents and on Thursday complaints that MP Clayton Mitchell was kicked out of a Tauranga bar for bad behaviour. More on that a bit later. Winston Peters is the leader of New Zealand First. He joined Giles Beckford on Friday's Morning Report.
First of all, what's the message you're going to give to your conference? Because you're in that triennial position, aren't you, where once again you've got to talk up the party's electoral prospects?
Well, the first thing I've got to do is talk up the proper lexicon when it comes to the MNP government, and to talk down the kind of rubbishy introduction that you just gave by talking about two bad polls. Your polls, as you well know, are chaff. My party's been around for 27 years, and election after election, you've written us off only to say at the last moment, like, oh, you can never be quite sure what New Zealand First might do. You put these rubbishy polls out to suggest that New Zealand First will be back. When we get back, you've never had, not just you personally, but your professionals never had the decency to apologise for misleading the New Zealand people. Polling is a very, very difficult business these days, and we've got polls that suggest what you're saying is absolute nonsense, and our polls spend more resource in getting the details right. So I do not want New Zealanders to be hearing this for the next month about what the media think of the New Zealand polls, when a party called New Zealand First and Winston Peters has defied those polls election after election after election, but like some sort of, I don't know, unbelievable influence, the media decide to actually just ignore that.
What do your polls show?
This rubbish out.
What do your polls show?
They show that we are comfortably in the zone to do extraordinarily well in 2020, as they showed in 2017. Do you remember 2017? The night the polls, Labour fell to 20% and New Zealand First had risen to 19%. None of you guys predicted that. None of you guys knew what was going on. But as a consequence, the Labour Party dropped its then leader, Andrew Little, and chose Jacinda Ardern, and the whole ball game changed. But that's the kind of things that were going on out there, whilst the moronic commentators in the media, and I'm going to say that because I'm sick and tired of their studied unfairness where one party is concerned, and claiming to understand what they're talking about.
So you're expecting to get back in with more seats?
try to save money, the guys pick that the matter you were dealing about before, Boris Johnson, was going to happen. Well, I personally did, and I did it 6 months beforehand, and I told you all. I not only picked that Trump was going to win, and I personally did, and I told you that beforehand. All that, for example, yeah. The Liberals were going to win again in Australia.
I'm not particularly interested in the history of predictions, Mr. Peters, but I am interested interested in the message you're going to be giving your party members and how you position your party going into election year in terms of having a distinct identity rather than being just absorbed inside coalition government.
I know why you're not interested in what I was telling about the three examples of poll predictions. It's because you guys got them all wrong, all three.
Well, that's a distraction, Mr. Peters, really. What policies are you going to put up? What messages are you going to give?
Look, it's not a distraction. Your very opening today was a distraction. I regret having to start on this program this way. I thought it should be a positive conversation. But when you launch your first sentence with a blatant mistake and a blatant error, we are not going to let that go because it's not the environment we want to be campaigning in. We want a fair go in this campaign.
All right. How are you going to pitch that message of give us a fair go? How are you going to differentiate NZ First as a distinct party that has electoral appeal?
Well, we're already doing that. Out in the provinces, we're getting enormous support building. We'll go to a highly enthusiastic conference. We're a party that knows we're going to have the best campaign, but then have the best campaign strategies. We're going to have the best campaign team. We've got no doubt the best campaign, and when it comes to what's relevant to so many New Zealanders, and that's my announcement is going to be on the weekend to New Zealand First, that we're in some enormous circumstances of opportunity this time round, that the last time campaign was highly successful, but the Labour Party changed its leader. This time, to ensure whatever the contingencies are, we need the strategy ready.
And above all,
we need the resources to be ready.
Are you a united party because you've got some disgruntled members who have been leaking documents? And do you need distractions such as Clayton Mitchell's kerfuffle and altercation in the Tauranga Bar?
Well, there you go again. Some distracted members. Some members who left after 2017 because they weren't high enough on the list and put out material from 2016 and in one small pocket and then complained about the election strategy of New Zealand First, the success of which I described to you, it ended up holding the balance of political power. I mean, if you've got members like that, you don't need members like that, you know?
Members like Clayton Mitchell.
We do need members like Clayton Mitchell. And let me tell you this, and here we go again with you guys in the media, and you're not getting away with it. Make one thing very, very clear in the 2020 campaign, and the marvellous thing about social media is some of you guys think you're going to determine the event with misinformation and fake news are not going to succeed. If any of the stuff about Clayton Mitchell, listen, if any of the stuff about Clayton Mitchell was remotely correct, why is he being invited back this weekend to observe the rugby on Sunday night? If there's any merit in anything you guys said, why would that invitation be the case? Because you fellas are not interested in facts. You're disinterested in spreading dirt, and sometimes that dirt's coming from the young Nats in this case.
Well, that's been denied. What we're actually wanting is just policies. We're wanting facts. We're wanting reasoned discussion. But
I'm putting to you a very logical question. You can't answer it.
I'm not here to be answering the questions, Mr. Peters. I'm trying to get you to answer them.
Well, I just answered it, and I said to you, I'm sure you put your head around that. I know it might be early in the morning, but you put your head around that. If it's anything's true about what they're saying about Mr. Mitchell, why did that very bar manager invite him back for this Sunday's All Black game?
New Zealand First leader Winston Peters on Morning Report. And New Zealand First's youth wing is at odds with its leader, Winston Peters, over pill testing at festivals and is working to overturn the party's position. The news comes after a One News Colmar Brunton poll which shows overwhelming public support for the policy, with 75% in favour of allowing festival goers to get their drugs tested legally. Here's our deputy political editor, Craig McCulloch.
With the summer festival season creeping ever closer and all the associated illicit activity, the question over whether punters should be able to get their drugs tested before taking them is increasingly salient. Public support for pill testing is high, and the policy's now won support from an unlikely corner, Young New Zealand First. The positions are a surprise because the party's caucus is so opposed. Indeed, New Zealand First MPs are the ones pulling the handbrake on any plans to push ahead. Labour wants to do it. So do the Greens. Both say it saves lives. But Winston Peters has repeatedly said no.
I think it's better to tell people that drugs and drug experimentation is an awfully risky, dangerous thing to do.
Now the party's youth wing is pushing back. Its chairperson, William Woodward, leading the charge. In a Facebook post in a private Young New Zealand First group, he encourages other members to lobby the party in support of testing stations at festivals.
The idea of pill testing stations is not based around assisting drug dealers, but rather saving the lives of Kiwis.
Mr. Woodward declined a request for an interview, but his Facebook post goes on to say,
in light of current events and increasing numbers of deaths as a result of the taking of unknown dangerous substances, Young New Zealand First calls for its membership to respond to our party's survey on the subject in favour of pill testing stations. We also encourage our membership, if they feel this subject is important to them, to join the executive of Young New Zealand First as we discuss our position and strategy for overturning the party's current policy.
It's understood the Young members will make their case at the party's annual conference, which kicks off in Christchurch tomorrow. Mr. Peters won't comment till he's heard it from them himself, but he says pill testing is a more complex matter than many think.
And so we're looking for solutions. We're not looking for problems to be expanded here.
Some festivals already allow testing stations on site, but those who run them, volunteers from Know Your Stuff, operate in a legal grey area. Its director, Wendy Allison, says it's positive to hear Young New Zealand First is pushing from within.
Good on them. All support is good support, but of course outcome is what we're after here.
She hopes the government parties can reach consensus this term, and the police minister, Stuart Nash, is also hopeful of a solution, though he says there's a little bit of water still to go under the bridge.
Discussions are ongoing. Young New Zealand First perhaps need to talk to their leader.
They'll get that opportunity this weekend, but may encounter some resistance, with Mr. Peters saying he's confident a significant majority of the party back its current position.
That's our Deputy Political Editor Craig McCulloch on Thursday's Morning Report. Occupiers of the disputed land at Ihumato have been shut out of talks with the government about finding a resolution, saying they haven't had any direct contact with ministers in over a month. The Māori King announced last month that Mana Whenua had reached a consensus that they want the land returned and urged the government to negotiate with the land's owner, Fletcher Building. But 86 days after the occupation at the South Auckland site gained national attention, Mana Whenua say they've been left in the dark and are no closer to finding a resolution. Te Anuā Hurahanganui filed this for Checkpoint.
It's been 3 months since those defending land at Ihumātau from a planned housing development were served with an eviction notice. In that time, there have been hour-long standoffs between occupiers and officers on the front line, a hikoi to the Prime Minister's electorate office, and protests inside Auckland Council offices. Then, a month ago, Mana Whenua announced they were now united in their position that they want the land returned. But Kiani Matata Sipu, a member of protest group Soul, says they haven't heard from the government since.
We haven't had any direct contact from anyone within the government or from any higher level representatives of Fletcher's. One of the things I do know or have heard is that the government have listened to the King's advice and have begun having conversations with Fletcher, but we're really not sure where those conversations are at, and I'm a little bit disappointed that they're not happening fast enough.
Kiani Matata Sipu says the delay isn't good enough and suspects it has something to do with the government treading carefully before the next election.
It's just ridiculous, really. I mean, this is a significant situation here in Aotearoa. I mean, I don't know whether this is a stalling tactic. I don't know whether they're still trying to figure out which way is the best way to go in the polls. Let's be real here. I think what the government needs to be looking at is doing the right thing, not doing the thing that's going to win them the most or the least amount of votes.
Finance Minister Grant Robertson met with Fletcher Building last month to discuss possible options, but won't say what was said or give a time frame of when a decision might be made. In a statement to RNZ, he says the government is focused on supporting a resolution that respects all the parties involved and is mindful of open heritage claims, the importance of not reopening treaty settlements and commercial interests in the site. Neither Māori Development Minister Nanaia Mahuta nor Tāmaki Makaurau MP Pēni Henare would comment. The Minister for Māori Crown Relations, Calvin Davis, is keeping tight-lipped too.
Yeah, that's not an issue that I'm responsible for. You'd have to ask probably PMO.
PMO, Prime Minister's Office, who referred us back to Grant Robertson. Fletcher Building also declined to speak, saying there was no update. The only person who does want to talk about Ihu Mātau is National Leader Simon Bridges.
I think we've got the worst of a bad situation. We're 80 days in and nothing is happening. And I think that's because the Prime Minister, having stuck her oar in, now isn't sure what to do. Because if you're on the one side of this and you're Fletcher's, you're not building any houses and you're seeing the value of your land go down. If you're on the other side, you are no closer to seeing a resolution of those land issues. It just simply drags on.
And while it is dragging on, Mana Whenua remain optimistic about the prospect of having the land, once stolen from their ancestors by the Crown, returned eventually. And in the meantime, they're pledging to occupy Ihu Mātau for as long as it takes.
Te Aniwa Hurihanganui with that report from Thursday's Checkpoint programme. You're listening to The Week in Review. Still to come, New Zealand First MP Clayton Mitchell describes reports he behaved badly at a bar as fake news and politically motivated. And which banger is best?
Every sausage coming in, you assume that it gets 100 points, and then you deduct points from there. So rather than going up, you're going down.
Still to come in The Week in Review. We were just doing our job. That's how the two police officers who took down the alleged mosque gunman described their actions on March 15th. The two officers were driving on Brougham Street in Christchurch, 5 minutes after the reports of shots being fired at the Linwood Mosque and 20 minutes after a gunman had started killing people at the Al Noor Mosque. The two officers saw a car which they believed was driven by the shooter and took the chance to stop and arrest the heavily armed man. On Wednesday, they were honoured for their work that day with the 2019 Police Association Bravery Award. Rachel Graham has more.
The two officers' names have been suppressed, so for now, they're only known as Officer A and B. In a joint statement, the men say that for them, knowing they played their part in possibly preventing further casualties was very important to them. They say their hearts go out to all the families whose lives were torn apart that day through death or injury. 51 people died from the mosque shootings and dozens were injured. The men say they were doing their job that day. They say all officers want to keep New Zealanders safe, and when they can't do that, it cuts deep. The president of the Police Association, Chris Cahill, says their actions may be one of the bravest performed by police officers in New Zealand.
It certainly has to be right up there. You know, making the decision to go forward and act and arrest that offender when there was clearly considerable risk is something that would take a lot of beating in any act of bravery.
It is believed that the gunman was on his way to another target. During the arrest, the officers seized two assault rifles and at least one semi-automatic rifle. The two officers say because they had a good knowledge of Christchurch and were experienced officers, they had the foresight to consider potential escape routes, which brought them to Brougham Street, one of the city's main roads. At that stage, they didn't know if there was more than one offender, but they believed there was a good chance the offender, or offenders, had left the mosques. The officers say they had known each other for years and had total trust in each other's abilities and that they would continue to do their job regardless of what they encountered. Chris Cahill says other officers are incredibly proud of the courageous actions of their colleagues.
It's very emotional for all the police officers, and you know, knowing that two of their officers stepped up and showed such amazing bravery when it was most needed, reflects on them all, and they're incredibly proud.
The award was presented by Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern this morning in a private ceremony. Ms Ardern says she is looking forward to a time when there can be a more public recognition of the men's actions.
There are some limitations, sadly, at the moment while we're still awaiting court proceedings, but thereafter I think the public would like the opportunity to hear more of their story and to really acknowledge them.
Chris Cahill says the two men are humble and a bit overwhelmed by the attention. He says it has been a challenging time for the officers in the subsequent months, but they have been offered extensive support.
We've had one of our field officers dedicated to looking after them, and police have also, working with police, psychological assistance been available to them, and just the ability to speak out and ask for help when they've needed it has been really important. And that sort of highlights that these people aren't superhumans. They're just like you and me and other police officers, but they acted with outstanding bravery that day.
The trial is due to start in June next year, but the case will be back in court in December for a pre-trial callover.
Rachel Graham with that report from Wednesday's Checkpoint programme. New imaging technology has revealed hundreds of major buildings nationwide have defective or missing concrete or reinforcing steel. Concrete investigators say their scanning shows many buildings have not been constructed according to the plans, and they are astounded and appalled. Phil Pennington filed this for Monday's morning report.
Wellington's Michael Roach Gray thought he'd seen everything after four decades of managing construction sites. That is, until he began looking into concrete, quite literally looking inside columns, beams, walls and floors using new ultrasound technology developed along with Crown agency Callaghan Innovation. He also uses ground radar and ferroimaging to see if there's enough steel inside the buildings.
Covering concrete, nobody will know. It's just the old story. Old adage. If it's not there, nobody will know. And when the structural elements aren't there, like they should be, like they're on the drawings, and they're sitting in the waste bin at the skip, they just say, oh, nobody will know.
Michael Roach Gray says it goes beyond a national crisis.
That's a nice way of putting it.
What's another way of putting it?
It's just bullshit.
Concrete Structure Investigations has scanned 1,200 buildings since 2016. 1,100 of them had missing concrete or steel. Apartment blocks, offices, public spaces, most of them built since the 1980s, some of them new, some of them unfinished. In Auckland, in Tauranga, Hamilton, Hawke's Bay, Christchurch. The company cannot identify the buildings for legal reasons. Commonly, consulting engineers who find one flaw call them in, only to find many others. And the worst that Michael Roach Gray has seen? An extension to a busy public building in Wellington, where the alarm bells went off after the Kaikoura earthquake and where heaps of steel was missing or faulty. Some of the buildings they have scanned have later had to be evacuated and repaired. Jane Roach Gray says about 60 buildings were so bad she wouldn't want to live or work in them. She ticks off half a dozen examples, such as a new building's basement 7 metres below sea level on the waterfront.
The waterproofing, we believe, from our data was botched. There was severe saltwater ingress into the new construction.
Or where they scanned for crucial steel connectors called drossbacks, steel tubes filled with incredibly strong glue called grout.
Worst case scenarios, we've found buildings where 70 to 100% would not be compliant. So there's either, in some cases, steel is missing, so it's been cut off.
Or found concrete so thin, the steel within was being quickly corroded.
We carried out a myriad of scans throughout a structure that isn't finished yet, and we can say that at least 30% of the data came back with non-compliant concrete cover.
Concrete Structure Investigations is confident that the better engineers are using the data they give them to fix the buildings. But they know that this is not always the case.
We were asked to come in and see if we could identify voids and inclusions in the foundations. Our impression was that as soon as we could identify a problem, they were keen to see us off-site.
They're also aware of legal action being taken, but in each case they know of, it's been settled out of court, keeping the problems out of the public eye.
Michael Roach-Gray says others are hiding major defects on site, such as at a concrete pour of a wall he scanned that was designed to carry earthquake loads.
The technology didn't really work that well for the installation of the concrete. The contractors on site decided they'd try and hide the fact. It was only by a fluke that the engineer happened to just see a spot on the concrete, and it was a little pothole, and he put his finger on it and stuck his finger right through it.
The wall was littered with invisible voids and had to be rebuilt. The pioneering technology has exposed evidence that building plans, no matter how good, are being ignored or ridden roughshod over.
That becomes down to the contractor who did the original job, chose to not have the skill set on site to construct the building as per the plans.
But how does that come to pass? Our next report will analyse the factors at play.
Phil Pennington with that report on Morning Report, and you can get more of this story from rnz.co.nz or from the Morning Report Facebook page. New Zealand First MP Clayton Mitchell has described reports he behaved badly at a bar on Saturday night as fake news and politically motivated. It's been reported that the second-term List MP and a friend were kicked out of a Tauranga bar after repeatedly being asked to move from an area because they were blocking staff access. But Mr. Mitchell says he was roughly handled by buffoon bouncers who completely overreacted. He also denies reports he accidentally hit a female bar staffer on the side of the head with a glass and says he thinks the young Nats are just trying to stir the story up. Political reporter Yvette McCullough has more from Thursday's Checkpoint program.
Clayton Mitchell says he and his friend were simply trying to get a drink at a busy bar. And if anything, security owes him an apology.
If standing at a bar that is busy ordering a drink has been a dick, then I think that's why they need to talk to the security member about their behaviour.
Clayton Mitchell says he did nothing aggressive and he and his friend had already moved away from the area when they were grabbed and forced out the door.
Look, I was actually on the phone to the owner at the time while trying to resolve this issue when I was grabbed quite forcefully by these buffoons. And at the end of the day, couldn't get through to him because he'd gone home. But there was no fighting. We were just trying to go out quietly and calmly. But it was a bit of a kerfuffle and I would say a huge overreaction.
Mr. Mitchell also denies accidentally hitting a female bar staffer on the side of the head, spilling a drink on her.
No, I've read the article. That's absolutely not true. That's fake news. That didn't happen.
He says the bar owner is following this up because the first he heard of the accusation was in media reports. Another report Mr. Mitchell is labelling fake news is claims he or one of his friends replied, "We are the law," when security threatened to call police.
That is another absolutely egregious claim that did not happen. I've spoken to my friend that I was with. He said, "I didn't say it," and I certainly didn't say it. He didn't say it. That's another just a fabrication trying to create a story that there isn't one.
The bar owner and the security guard involved have not yet responded to RNZ's request for comment. But Mr. Mitchell believes he knows where the story's coming from.
And I think it's politically motivated. We know the young Nats are in behind trying to stir something up here.
However, the young Nats say this issue has nothing to do with them. In a statement, President Sam Steed says they wouldn't waste their time on an MP they've never heard of. New Zealand First leader Winston Peters says video from the bar of the incident proves Mr. Mitchell did nothing wrong.
Now look, you're just scaremongering, making it up as you go along. Why don't you look at the video? That exonerates Mr. Mitchell totally.
Although Mr. Peters admits he hasn't seen the video with his own eyes.
No, I know enough about it to be confident about it because somebody I've got enormous trust in has seen it.
Winston Peters says he's confident the video shows any alarm or concern about Mr. Mitchell's behaviour isn't justified in any way.
Yvette McCullough with that report from Checkpoint. And on Friday, the main security guard involved in that incident, John Dominey, was calling for CCTV footage to be released, saying it will back his version of events. More than 1,000 people packed into Stadium Southland on Wednesday to hear Blair Vining deliver his own eulogy. The cancer care advocate, who died last Friday, was farewelled in Invercargill by a huge crowd, with many people wearing their favourite rugby jerseys at his request. Our Otago Southland reporter Timothy Brown was at the memorial service. He filed this report.
When Blair Vining found out last year that he had inoperable terminal bowel cancer, he decided he was going to go out on his own terms. Today, the 39-year-old father of two delivered on that promise and delivered his own eulogy. Speaking in a pre-recorded video message, he told the crowd his life changed forever almost 2 decades ago when he met his future wife Melissa and her then young daughter Della May.
You never think, oh, I'm going to, when you wake up in the morning, meet the lady of my dreams and I'll be bloody bouncing her kid on my knee at 6 o'clock at night, you know? And,
yeah.
And I loved Della May right from the day one. She was a big part of your life and she is a big part of my life now, and she is my daughter.
Mr. Vining says an incredible 17 years of marriage followed, as did the birth of his youngest daughter, Lily, who is now 13 years old.
That time has gone so fast. It was a very, very awesome upbringing with Lily. Like, we were up on living on a dairy farm. We bought a dairy farm, and she's just my best little buddy, hooning around everywhere with me, and I got to spend some real, real good quality years with her before she went to school.
He paid tribute to Melissa, saying she was the woman who has driven him through everything he has achieved.
You are the rock behind everything that we do. You're the driving force for everything we do, and it's really, really hard for me to let go. I am the luckiest husband in the world, to be fair. I really am.
Earlier, Della May told the crowd she has signed the paperwork to legally change her last name to Vining.
Now, I love netball like Dad loved his rugby. And for you, Dad, I will keep trying and trying until I reach my / our goal of playing professional netball. Dad, it's my turn to make a bucket list. On it will be getting that black dress with Vining on the back for you. And every game I play, I will carry you in my heart and play with pride, just like you always said.
Mr. Vining insisted on not having a traditional funeral. Lily made sure everyone knew what it was about.
Today is not a funeral, it's a celebration of life about an amazing selfless hero. I was lucky enough to have this hero as my dad.
As part of breaking with tradition, Mr. Vining wanted everyone to wear a rugby jersey, and no crying was allowed. Melissa Vining says they didn't see eye to eye about everything.
Leah comes up with the ideas, and I'm his PA behind the scene doing the paperwork, and he organised his own funeral. It's very strict instructions. I definitely did not like the dress code. We had many, many discussions about this.
After 17 years of trying to get his wife to wear a rugby jersey, she says she finally relented today, wearing a rugby jersey worn by Kieran Reid and gifted to Mr. Vining. She says while wearing it, he felt like Spartacus. He was described as many things: a great husband, a great father, a lover of rugby and cars, and someone who would do anything for anyone. His older brother, Sean Vining, summed him up in the kind of blunt and straightforward terms Blair most appreciated.
I believe that Blair Emery Vining, that's right, his middle name is Emery, should be found guilty of being an absolute legend.
Mr. Vining's beloved Central Southland College First 15, a team he coached and even as he was fighting cancer raised funds for to take on a tour of Australia earlier this year, farewelled him with a hucket as his coffin was laid onto a Ford ute. As many at the service reflected, Mr. Vining's 39 years of life will have an impact on New Zealanders for generations to come.
Our Otago Southland reporter Timothy Brown with that report from Wednesday's Checkpoint program. That's Oh Superman by Laurie Anderson. It came out almost 40 years ago and is part of her extensive and wide-ranging career. Laurie Anderson has now added co-curator of the New Zealand Arts Festival to her CV. She's one of three artists invited to schedule a week-long program. One of four shows she's bringing out for the festival is Lou Reed Drones, that creates a soundscape from the guitars of her late partner and Velvet Underground frontman Lou Reed.
A lot of those guitars that in the intro to his rock shows. After Lou died, we wanted to do some things with, really to listen to his music, and since he wasn't there, we thought, well, let's use his guitars and just set that up as a sound installation, kind of. And it's just been amazing, because it was not something that I could ever have predicted. It was just, we would set these up and people would come and bring their instruments and just play with the drones. Or they would come and do ballet or Tai Chi, or they'd bring their laptop and write their novel. In other words, you have to surrender to this sound. You know, you come into this thing and you're like, what is this? I almost can't stand it, but it's got my alpha waves going, and so you kind of collapse on the floor and you're like, whoa.
Laurie Anderson, as heard on Friday's Morning Report. Another is a symbolic work called Here Comes the Ocean, and there's even a free concert specifically for dogs. Laurie Anderson joins the actor and composer Brett McKenzie and director and choreographer Lemmy Ponifacio as the three guest curators of the festival, which runs from February 21st to March 15th next year. Marni Kamalita is the creative director of the festival. She joined Giles Beckford.
Well, Laurie Anderson is a guest curator. For those who don't know, just how significant as an artist is she?
Oh, she has just had the most extraordinary career, I think, so far reaching, and she crosses all boundaries in terms of art form. But I think she's just made the most significant contribution to culture and the arts. And so we are so delighted to welcome her back to New Zealand. She actually performed in the first New Zealand Festival of the Arts in 1986. And comes back to us in this new model that we have, inviting incredible artists to help select the program.
So as a co-curator, what will her actual job be? What contribution will she make?
Well, and she's been working on it now for the last 12 months or so as we've shaped the program. So she has actually selected a number of events, up to 6 events, for the second week of the festival. So people can come along to one or all of those events and really investigate Laurie as an artist and see what inspires her and makes her tick.
Is she doing any performances herself?
She sure is. She'll actually be involved in quite a number of the performances herself. I don't think we could keep her away from the stage, but there will also be other events sitting around her series that she has just brought to us and will present as part of her series.
Let's not forget the other couple of co-curators that you've got there, Brett McKenzie and Lenny Ponifacio. What are you expecting them to arrange for you?
Well, they have also really put their own stamp and style on each of their weeks. So Lemmy joins us for the first week of the festival, and he is such an extraordinarily gifted theatre maker, and really his work is embedded in New Zealand, but with such a global outlook. He has such a following worldwide, particularly in Europe. And then, of course, as you would expect, Brett's just bringing the fun for the third week of the festival. And he's obviously a Wellington boy, hometown boy, and he's been really impacted by the festival in his life and work. And he's bringing some great events that are going to get people out into theatres, seeing work, musicians together, and also out into nature as well. He is really so obsessed with our beautiful landscape and environment in Wellington.
So how's the rest of the program coming along? What else can we expect?
Oh, you can expect just the, you know, usual array of everything from theatre, dance, music, visual art, film, and you can expect it to take over the city in February and March for 3.5 weeks.
Can you give us any sneak previews, any little hints about what we might look forward to?
Oh, well, I think you mentioned one of the things that people will get really excited about, a certain canine concert. But we've also got an extraordinary series of projected artworks across the city that people will be able to access for free.
That's the creative director of the New Zealand Arts Festival, Marni Kamalita, speaking on Morning Report. Which banger is best? Well, on Thursday night, the country was about to find out just that. The winners in the Devro Great Sausage Competition were due to be announced, including the coveted Supreme Award. More than 500 sausages from nearly 100 stores entered the competition, and standing in the way between them and the top prizes are 6 judges. Jesse Chang met up with the judges to find out what makes a good sausage.
The familiar sound of a sizzling sausage. It conjures images of hot sun, shorts and picnics on a summer afternoon. But a good sausage isn't about the sizzle.
I think a good sausage has to smell like summer, and I think it should have a beautiful skin that just sort of almost is crisp as you cut through it, a beautiful centre of taste and herbs, and a bit of a taste explosion. Not too fatty, a mix of flavours and yeah, just all-round balance and texture. It's got to feel good in the mouth.
That's Trudy Nelson, one of the six judges who are sampling entries in the 14 categories, which include black pudding and gourmet. The winners in each then go head-to-head in the coveted Supreme Sausage Award. Ms. Nelson says there have been a few standout unusual combinations in the past, with cheese or fruit mixed in with the meat. But she's also a stickler for classics.
As a mum of three boys, I've also got to think about the family. So my whole thing is when I'm throwing sausages on the barbie, I will have a few that are a bit more out there, like a chorizo or a chicken plum and brie. But I think that it's important to find a really good beef one, or a really beef and onions, a nice one, or pork.
For fellow judge Hannah Miller-Childs, texture is a vital characteristic.
I want it to have some good meaty texture where you can actually sense that there's bits of meat in it, where it's not just all soft or all hard, but there's different textures going on. And then, of course, having that skin be nice and crispy so that it snaps straight away when you bite into it.
On hand to cook up the sausages is Jeff Ibbotson.
The best thing to keep in mind with a sausage is to cook it at low temperature, and that'll prevent any splitting of the skin. Minimal oil, because there's enough fat usually in the sausage. And a good, decent pan.
But he says there's also something about the barbie that gives it broad appeal.
The feel of cooking a sausage on a barbecue, I think people are more, they can smell it outside. It's primitive cooking. I'm a sort of outdoor person, so yeah, I would prefer to cook outside.
The sausages being served up have already proved their worth, each having secured a category gold medal. This year, options for the Supreme Award range from beef pre-cook to barbecue Asian pork belly and cashew. All of them are about to face their toughest test yet.
It smells synthetic. Yeah. Nothing wrong with
the pump, is it? Well, it's not the winner,
so.
No.
It's final judging day, and no one is holding back. Hannah Miller-Childs breaks down how they score each sausage.
Every sausage coming in, you assume that it gets 100 points, and then you deduct points from there. So rather than going up, you're going down. We speak as a group about how we're going to judge to make sure that we're fair across the entire day. And what I do is I then take off. If there's too much fat, that might only lose, you know, 1 point. But then if when it's cooked, it's actually crumbly and dry, then that would lose another point.
It's a serious business. After all, as Trudy Nelson puts it, sausages are linked to the New Zealand national identity.
I think that it's really entrenched in our society because it's a feasting thing, and that, exactly like I say, that fresh bread, the sausage, the squirt of tomato sauce, you know, the salad on the side of the plate, and being around people is just absolutely part of us. So it's a bit like a pie, a pavlova and a sausage. We wouldn't be Kiwi without it.
The winners will be announced in Auckland tonight.
Jessie Chang with that report from Thursday's Morning Report. And an Auckland butchery took out New Zealand's top sausage award for the second year running. The Westmere Butchery's chicken, leek and bacon entry beat out more than 500 other snags for the top spot of the Great New Zealand Sausage Competition. One of the judges, Annabelle White, said the top sausage was extraordinarily delicious and full-bodied. And finally, in the Week in Review, with just 10 days until voting opens, young New Zealanders are flocking to support their favourite bird of the year. Competition is fierce this year, with the reigning Keriru vying to keep its top spot. But a change in the voting system means some of the lesser-known birds might get a look in. Our Youth Affairs reporter Katie Doyle has the story.
Will it be the pesky kea, the classic kiwi, or the round rifleman? If 16-year-old conservationist George Hobson gets his way, it'll be the banded dotterel or pohowera, soaring to success.
They're just absolutely gorgeous. They're floofy, but they're also incredibly endangered. So they have got the same endangered species ranking as the takahe, as two species of kiwi, and as the pheal. So they desperately need more public recognition and more conservation support as well.
George is passionate about conservation and New Zealand's wildlife, but he worries not everyone understands how threatened our native species are.
Lots of New Zealanders aren't aware of what a dire state our New Zealand birds and all wildlife is actually in. We've got 4,000 species threatened or at risk of extinction, so anything we can do to help raise the profile of those endangered species is really a very good thing.
Amber Kelman, who's 17, has taken to Twitter to cheer for the black-billed gull, or tarapuka. The most endangered gull in the world, it's thought to be a bit of an underdog.
Black-billed gull is pretty unknown and often gets mixed up with similar species such as the red-billed gull, but both species are struggling, and black-billed gull in particular is nationally critical, so I think it needs a bit more attention than it's currently getting.
Previously, Bird of the Year has operated under First Past the Post, but this time voters will be asked to rank their top picks from 1 to 5, much like how people voted in the local elections. Amber Kelman supports that change.
I think it's a good idea. I think people can, with this system, are more likely to vote for some of the less popular birds that they don't know quite as well, which will get them more attention in the long run.
A Bird of the Year spokesperson, Megan Hubshire, says the competition lends itself well to social media, which may be why young people get so involved. But she says rangatahi are also incredibly aware of problems facing the environment.
You know, recently we had school strike for climate led 170,000 people down the streets of New Zealand. And, you know, it could be that we're seeing a reflection of this growing concern and appreciation of how, you know, special and amazing New Zealand's native species are.
Voting for Bird of the Year opens on Monday 28th October and closes on Sunday 10th November. You can find out more about the feathery candidates on the Forest and Bird website.
Our Youth Affairs reporter Katie Doyle with that report from Friday's Morning Report. And that ends this edition of The Week in Review. The next program will be available to download next Friday evening, New Zealand time. You can also catch up on the week's sporting highlights in the podcast Extra Time from RNZ Sport. All podcasts at rnz.co.nz. For now, from me, Paul Brennan, kia pai te wiki. Have a great week.